This is an interview recorded on July the 2nd, 1970, in the offices of Vice President Donald R. Mallett for Vice President for Student Services and Professor Eccles Department of History. And this is to be used by the Purdue University Archives. Don, let's start out with the obvious question. Where were you born? Where were you educated? Your family background, and then, if you will, with dates and times, bring us up to the time you first came to the Purdue campus.
Okay, Bob, I was born in July 1910. On a farm west of Guthrie Center, north and west of Guthrie Center, Iowa. We, as a family, I was the only child at that time, moved to Des Moines, and I started kindergarten and the rest of the public school program, that is elementary, junior high, and high school, and the Des Moines Public Schools. Following graduation from there, I entered Drake University in Des Moines.
What year?
In the year 1927. And graduated from there in June of 31 with a major in chemistry. My father was in the pharmaceutical manufacturing business, was a registered pharmacist, and up until sometime during my senior year, I think it had been simply assumed that I would go into the business, in as much as I was the only son among all of the officers. I entered a state of rebellion, I guess it could be called, in the senior year, and the last half of the senior year switched over to education. Got a job coaching football, basketball, wrestling, and teaching physics and freshman math.
Had you lettered in these sports at Drake?
No, I had gone out for football, but had been on the squad, but never good enough to letter. I'd played some basketball in the intramural area, a good deal of it. I did play basketball in high school. Wrestling was brand new. I spent a year at Belle Plaine, Iowa. That was where my employment was. And decided at the end of the year that my future certainly was not in the area of physical education in any form. And I left Belle Plaine. And in the fall...
Belle Plaine is in French, B-E-L-L-E, isn't it?
This is right. This was, it's a town about 35 miles west of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, almost straight west. In fact, I think when I was there, that one of the points of interest was that between Belle Plaine and Cedar Rapids was the longest stretch without a turn on what, in those days, and you will remember, the highway was called the Lincoln Highway.
Lincoln Highway. I do remember it. I've been bogged down in the mud in Iowa.
Well, it was all paved where I was at that time anyhow. There was plenty of mud in Iowa. Well, I then entered the University of Iowa in the fall in psychology. That time there was virtually no educational institution in the Middle West, the exception of Minnesota, which gave personnel training per se. So I entered as a major in psychology and went through my master's and doctorate's degree, receiving my PhD in the summer of 36.
That was 4 years.
That's right.
And what was your subject of your thesis?
Oh, heavenly days. I can't give you the official title at the moment. I don't remember. It was a study of the predictive value in terms of motivation of some of the tests, which in those days we had all freshmen take when they came to college. There was not much connection between anything we gave, we decided, and what I think we would define as motivation. And I'm not sure we measure motivation much better now than we did then. But
was this when Seashore was in the Department of Psychology, or was yours Ed Psych?
No, mine was psychology. Seashore was on my committee. Stoddard was on my committee. Lindquist, who organized the American College Testing Program, was on the committee. It was a very interesting group of men. I don't know how far you want to go with this. I'll go ahead.
Sure.
I took a job at the university then in the Dean of Men's office as Assistant Dean of Men, and we set up a housing program. That's the wrong terminology. We started to work on the housing of the students that were living in private homes. And as you also recognize, back in those days, we were in the Depression. We were not building dormitories. Boys did, and girls too, did live in private homes, and we had the old time boarding house, which as far as I know has disappeared entirely now. And of course at the time I was at Iowa, we were in the midst of the Depression of the 30s. And this was really, I suppose, part of the overtone that we were trying to follow through on. It's quite interesting, some of the things you found. Remember, four boys ran onto them in November, who were going to school and doing really pretty good work. Since the beginning of school, they had not had enough money to actually buy a meal as we would know it today. Their basic menu, day in and day out, was composed of soda crackers and apples they could steal along the roadway as they walked out of town, various roads. But they wanted an education and were getting it. Of course, we had the NYA. We also were an experimental program where they went out and picked boys up, young men up, across the country and sent them there to go to school and furnished everything. This lasted about 90 days. By that time, they'd all taken their overcoats, clothes, and other belongings the government had bought for them, and either hitchhiked or ridden the freight trains out of town. We didn't have any students, that was all. Well, I stayed on at Iowa until the Second World War, which time I went into teaching.
You were in the Dean of Men's office?
Yes. At which time I was teaching in the pre-meteorological program, which was then under the auspices of the Army. And at the close of the war, it closed up. It closed up, as I recall, right at the beginning of 45. They had all the men in the pipeline that they could get.
Did you stay in Iowa City with
right,
this work?
Right. In fact, that was that and the V-12 program.
V-12 was very big at Iowa City, if I remember.
Yeah, there were only two of those schools, I think, in the country. Then I interviewed one whole day, I guess, practically. George Davis, who had been made head of the Office of Student Affairs over here.
George was brought over from Keokuk, Iowa.
Yes, in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
Or somewhere along
yes.
in there. He and F.B. Knight, I think, came over at about the same
That's
time.
That's right. F.B. Knight brought him over.
And, well, F.B. Knight was another member of, remember, he was an ed psychologist, educational psychologist. George had been in teacher placement. President Eliot had established the Office of Student Affairs right at the end of his term of office. I cannot give you dates. I don't remember exactly when George came over. I know I was over here two or three times and accepted the job. I can't remember exactly when I came. I know by the time I came, the Office of Student Affairs had really been made the Office of the Dean of Men. The Board of Trustees had switched it back, although it may have carried the title, Student Affairs. And this was after the war was over. So then I came here in, let's say, the first, tail end of 45, first of 46. About the same time President Hovde came. And here we are.
All right. Now, I think we should talk about the post-World War II problem with the students and university as you encountered it, and then what you did specifically, that is individually, in the Office of Student Affairs. As I remember, because I was here then too, there were some very serious problems about housing and veteran morale and...
Yeah, if you remember before that, Bob, when I got here, we didn't have very many civilian students. I can't remember the exact number, but it was down under 5,000, as I recollect. When I arrived, they were still operating on a program where they admitted new students every 8 weeks, all year long. This was just an ongoing process. I think it was the second day I was on campus. Dr. Davis told me that they were admitting some students, and he'd like to have me go over and with him to talk to them. I said, well, what is your orientation program? He said, what? He said, well, what do you do to orient the students? how do they know anything about the university? Well, I said, I don't know. Nobody tells them anything. Maybe that's the reason we lose so many. And I said, well, I'm not sure of the connection, but I think they ought to know a little bit. Well, we went over, and the group coming in that particular 8 weeks, as I recall it, was somewhere around 40, 45. I don't know how to tell you. Well, it's where the Cypress, it was where the Cypress Room is now in the Memorial Center, the old coffee shop. In the Student Union building, it had this winding counter made up of series of views, you remember. After Dr. Davis had talked to him, I suggested that they all go down with us to the coffee shop. There's plenty of room. Bought them a Coke, and then we just wandered around while they were drinking their Cokes, answering questions. Well, this could have gone on, I don't know how long, certainly until midnight at the rate we were going. We finally bid them adieu and got them on their way. And I remember Dr. Davis saying it was over. Well, your first job is to see we get an orientation program started. We'll never go through this again. I didn't realize how much students didn't know. So we did get an orientation program, and it's been running ever since. Certainly has changed with the change in registration, which we'll probably get into later. Immediately following this, within the next 6 months, the veterans began to come out in tremendous numbers. We must recognize that the veterans of World War II had been in for, some of them, 4 and 5 years of military service. For that reason, they tended to be older. High percentage of them were married. And they were a highly motivated group of men that just didn't want to monkey around. They wanted to get on with the job. We soon ran out of housing space as the university grew. By the next summer, we were through with the 8 weeks admission and went back to the same program I have now at the beginning of each semester and summer session. Well, our big job really became one of finding space in private homes and digging up space in the university. We hired 2 or 3 assistants in the office that did nothing but tramp the streets, finding a place for a man or two, or a man and his wife, whatever it may be, to live. And I must say that the citizens of West Lafayette and Lafayette, I think, were the greatest group of people I could imagine. And this is not malarkey now at all. Because people that had never let out a room, emptied a bedroom in order to help these boys who'd been fighting in the war get an education. It's just fantastic how many rooms we found in town. On campus, I'm sure you remember the men's gymnasium up in the gymnasium on the second floor. We put in triple-deck beds and had them about as close together as you could possibly get them. In the whole area there, we were up in the top floor, which is now used for activities, I think some, but had no students there. Top floor of Carey Hall, the attic in the Ag Engineering Building, and other nooks and crannies around the campus that we could find to put one or two men on, up to 100 or whatever you could get. Building, I think, is gone now. At least I can't identify it. If it's not gone, it's been renovated. Duncan Electric had had a manufacturing plant where they were doing some secret manufacturing, classified manufacturing, out about where Market Square is now. They gave us that to use. We ran buses, shuttle bus service, back and forth to the Duncan Electric Building. If I make mistakes, you can help straighten me out if your memory is different than mine. Well, we had enrollment double practically overnight. It didn't get up to anything like it is now. Then we got into the building, expansion of the dormitory system. But the housing was the first big problem we ran into.
You were actually faced with taking a university of around 4,000 and taking care of one around 12 or 15, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes, I think we reached our peak right around 50 when we were about 15.5, isn't
that? That's correct. And then it started to fall back a little.
That's right, as the stream of veterans fell off. And, this was the big thing you had. Now, along with this, in those first few years, of course, everything had to start up again.
You had to get the old Ken building torn down and the present one put up.
Yes.
And you had to make use of the temporary shops that are temporary buildings in chemistry.
That are still temporary buildings in chemistry.
Yeah.
Out on State Street, you recall we brought in I don't know how many barracks. Remodeled them.
Now you had them on both sides of the airport road.
Right.
And then you had somebody design a special...
Yeah, I was going to get the what we call the black and whites.
That's right.
No, the...
I remember those very vividly.
Barracks we brought in on either side of Airport Road, I think we had around 1,000 of those. They ran two or four to a building, depending on what they were when we got them. Then Carl Bester designed a prefabricated home, which we could produce ourselves, and we set up an assembly line in the armory. And hired people in, ran 24 hours a day, and that's where they made what they call the black and whites. Now, all of these are gone from the campus.
Don't you even have one to preserve it? That was a marvelous building.
If you'll drive out in the country, I can show you some that were moved out of town.
You know, you ought to have some preserved because it was 120 degrees upstairs if it got cold, and you had an inch of ice on the baseboards.
Is right. They were not man's greatest friend and comfort, but at least they could live in them.
You could move yourself and two kids into it and camp out.
This is right. The little apartments weren't much better that we had for the students. The black and whites were primarily faculty and staff housing, you remember.
Yes, I remember.
But there, I don't know where you can find one of the little barracks. We did sell some of the black and whites, and they were moved to spots outside the city. I can take you to one out in 26, but I can't tell you how to get to it. These are, gosh, you should think back.
Well, now, did you run, was this your mainly your baby, taking care of the housing?
No. Nobody had a baby then. You had so many students that you took care really of what you could. There were three of us down in the Dean of Men's office. Bob Horn, who is now head of the speech program up the Calumet regional campus, Davis and myself, and we were trying to ride herd.
You were it.
This is right.
Well, I remember the place, the veterans coming back, the problem, quite frankly, of men who'd been fighting and had been used to a different kind of female companionship than they were apt to get from our young undergraduates. I remember the whole bit.
It created problems, although it's amazing how well we came through. I remember in this same period, I can't tell you, I think it was the basketball season of 46, but it may have been in 47 when the bleachers collapsed.
That was, I believe, in 46, February or March.
If I were to
guess,
I would have said 46.
Yeah.
And I'm amazed to find students and staff that had never heard of this. Some had been here quite a little while. Where we, in order to accommodate the increased student body, we had run the bleachers darn near up the top of the, what was in the field house. We did not have the basketball arena, of course. And as we came to the halftime, the teams left the floor. The whole east bleachers just collapsed.
You killed how many?
There were three killed in there. They were three men, students. All of them had slipped between the seats and were under the bleachers by the time they fell. We really were quite lucky.
I remember one thing about that. The panic stopped at once. The veterans knew what to do. They took laid anyone out, covered them up at once, laid them out on a board so they could be moved for stretchers. It was probably the finest example of how men reacted. And there was a great calmness.
This is right. And if we had some that became hysterical, and they handled them very effectively. If it was a man, they hauled off and poked him in the jaw and laid him down on the floor.
That's right.
When he came to in 10 seconds, he was all right.
Yeah.
But it was a woman, they just slapped her across the face 3 or 4 times, and she was all right. We ended up with around 500 injuries. Of course, the hospitals were jammed, and every doctor and nurse in town was overworking. George and I were together at the game. And after we were sure there was nothing more we could do at the field house, we had gotten together and sort of organized. We were to take care of notifying the parents. So then we went over to the hospitals and got terrific cooperation. Got names of patients that were in whether they'd been treated or not. Guesses, at least, as to the seriousness, and an agreement that we could have a runner service, a student with a car that would go back and forth and bring us additional information. We came back over the building. Telephone company gave us 5 lines, long-distance lines, and I would place 3 calls at a time. Operator stayed right with us. We would notify the parents, and as soon as that was done, we'd go to the next one. And by about 7 or 8 in the morning, we had reached everyone. I remember I didn't go home till 6:30 that night, and I was pretty tired young man. I'm glad. I hope I didn't make any decisions during the last 2 hours, because I'm not sure what they would have been. But the campus came back from that. We were playing Wisconsin. The game was, of course, postponed. We played it, if my memory is correct, down at Butler Field House later on. And then we started the splitting the student body so that half went to one game and half to the other. We didn't try to take all students in again. Well, there are other things, but anything in particular.
Well, now let me ask you about the internal organization of the Office of the Dean of Men, because as I remember, about 1951 or 52, George Davis became, went over to become in charge of the adult education program. And you and O.D., now I do not know what how it happened, but O.D., for the tape, it's O.D. Roberts. What was your title and how did you move?
Well, I was Associate Director of Student Affairs at the time George moved over. This is right. We knew he was moving, and I think 52 is the right year. And I brought O.D. in from the University of Oklahoma to take my place, since I'd been asked to move off into George's place. And we changed the name of the office back to the Dean of Men's office. At that time, Al Schliemann, who was resigned, retired now, was in office there. And that's how O.D. came in, and I became Dean of Men then from 52 until 56, when I moved out in the president's staff.
All right, let's just stop right there and talk about the changes and the major problems that a Dean of Men faced after the war. Because one of the great comments that been made at the present time, and perhaps with some relevancy, is that things have changed so fast that the Dean of Men in many universities and the Dean of Women in many, I don't say here, have not kept up with the people they're serving. For example, the Dean of Men is concerned about whether or not they have a class election. 85% of the class really doesn't care whether you have an election or not. Now, you've got a series of questions on that that I, for the tape, let's take them in order, and I'd like to have you get on to that.
Well, let's go back to the discussion you were having, because that isn't on here, and I think you're right. I'm not sure that more than 15% gave a darn whether they had a class officer or not back in those days. The class officers, I think, basically have always been a product of the politically minded students within the student body, and there's a certain percentage. And this hasn't changed very much, really. There are some advantages from the university's point of view in having class officers. At least you've got somebody you can go to and say, now, can you reach your class on this? Otherwise, you paw around out in nothingness and can never get your communication set up.
You end up with the kind of student who becomes Jane Fonda.
Yeah, get oriented before you turned on here.
All right, we were talking about, when we went off the tape, we were talking about class selections and students and how the administration could use student officers to talk to them. Yes.
I have never made a study of this. In fact, you raise an interesting question. As I think back, I would guess that between 75% and 90% of the students that were in the so-called political jobs, or that were the leaders, what we now call student leaders, were the non-veterans that came to campus. The man that had been overseas and had lost as much time, who was married, who may have had one or two or three kids, he wanted an education. I think you can recall that the grades of the university just shot right straight up in the air.
Those men had a purpose. They had worked out these childish frustrations. They knew exactly what they wanted to do. I have never had students as good as those men. Never.
Well, I think this is right. There's only one group that we might discuss a little later, and that's the NESEP group that's come in here in the Navy program in the last 14 years, but we can discuss those later. But they had many of the same characteristics in being older. But there is something happens to the man who comes to school 3, 4, 5 years after the typical student. He just lived longer, that's all. And something happens to him, and I'm not dead sure what it is. He's had more experience. But time's a little more precious to him. Well, I thought, Bob, that we might go down some of the things that we have done during the time I've been working in the personnel areas, and then we can move from that over to what's happened in the last decade and where we are now, but we'd ought to clean it up first, I think.
Very good. Let us then talk about some of the special projects.
Well, there were some things that we had to, if I can interrupt, that we had to make ourselves. I'm not criticizing it. We had a religious camp that was put on by the ministers. And they did a good job for what they wanted to get out of the camp. They went out to the YMCA camp on the Tippecanoe River here, 30 miles out. Most of us were out there sometime during the camp as part of the program. One night it dawned on us that we were coming back from that camp, that if we could get a camp of potential leaders, of young men, and we did keep it to just men, who had proven themselves leaders in the campus. Now we're out of the veterans era, basically. We've got veterans in school, but they're not coming in at the freshman level.
This starts after 50.
Well, I think this actually started in 49, to be honest with you.
Yes, but the veterans were setting out.
Yeah, they weren't coming in as freshmen. We started a freshman camp. It was one of the first ones in the Middle West. Went out to the old civil engineering camp, which now is a 4-H program out there. To this, we asked the high school principals of the state to refer students who were entering college for the first time, coming to Purdue from their high school, and who had proven themselves to be leaders. This was a thrilling experience. These kids were well selected. They were leaders. We talked to them about the university, gave them a chance to talk about their dreams, hopes, and so on. Had a counselor for about every 8 or 10 men, and it worked out very, very well. It was a 2-day plus one night period. This went on for a period of 8-9 years until it got so big there was no place to hold it and we just had to give it up. The old master's program, which is still running, started in the late 40s. This started and I was part of the starting. I guess I didn't finish in the freshman or on the leadership camp. I was sitting in the back of Dean Huckerman's car. There were four of us. We talked about it. As we drove in town, he said, "Malin, take this over and let's get it going." And that's where it got started. On the old masters, we had a couple of boys that came in and said, "We'd like to talk sometime about what the students can do. What can we get out of the community that we're not getting now?" He said, "We don't quite understand what you mean." I said, "Well, we'd like to talk to each other, to some businessmen, to some university men. It's part of this motivation that the veterans had." So the airport was entirely different then than it is now. You may recall they had their own kitchen out there and so on. And we set up a evening meal. Remember, we had steaks, which indicates that inflation is taking place. We couldn't do that now. And we must have had 35 or 40 students, men and women, that they had picked out. And I suspect five or six businessmen. Most of them, maybe more than that, I can remember that many. I think all but one I remember has passed away. Sam Keller was there. And it was George and I sat back mostly. Listen, what came out in the end was a very simple concept. The students were really asking for some type of program where they could talk about, could talk with successful people out in the world.
What's it like out there? How should I prepare? What is useful in studies?
Now, this was the basic idea. At about the same time, within a month of this period of time, a gentleman who had been on the Purdue staff many years ago, by the name of George Wallace, came onto the campus. He was a retired consulting engineer, and he came in to see Dr. Davis about the same type of thing, but coming at it from the other end. I'm sure that to some extent he was thinking of himself, but he had plenty to do. But his whole thesis was that every year there are hundreds of men and women retire in this nation who take with them hundreds and hundreds of years of experience. And once it's gone, it's gone. They're not going to write it down. They're not going to pass it on. And yet almost every one of these would delight in having the opportunity to sit down and talk with a group of college men and women, and to talk about what his success might have come from. Well, he had the name Old Masters. We took that. We didn't feel we wanted all retired people. In fact, now we've moved to where we have virtually none that are retired, or very few. And of course, his idea also was that we would have all college people. And this has not worked out. But we took this back to the students who had been at the dinner. And they thought it'd be wonderful. So we got a small grant from President Hovde to pay travel expenses for these people and started a 4-day program.
I remember I helped bring Thurman Arnold here.
Yes, he was one of the first ones
I did that.
From Brown University?
No. Thurman Arnold. Remember, he was the former Solicitor General of the United States. Man who wrote the great book, The Folklore of Capitalism, one of our nation's leading lawyers.
Yeah.
I remember particularly his debating with students in the Great Issues class and supporting Harry Truman.
Well, that was the time.
Yes,
this times
it
pretty
time.
Well.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we suddenly discovered this wasn't as easy as it sounded. When you'd go ask people, they'd look at you and look at you seriously as though you were crazy. I can't remember the gentleman's name who was president of American Bridge, which of course was a wholly owned subsidiary of U.S. Steel. He was out of Pittsburgh and had his office in the U.S. Steel building there. He finally agreed to come. And we dug up 8 or 9 or 10 of these and had pretty good press coverage on it. Had them booked every hour they were here. I never will forget, McDonald was the man's name from American Bridge. And we had heard that he was staying up a good share of the night every night. It came time to break up and we were over saying goodbye to them as they left. McDonald came out from the union rooms. Said, well, the first thing I'm going to do is get out of here and get some sleep. And he said, this isn't your fault. He said, the second thing I'm going to do is tell anyone else that hears about this and gets a chance to come. He said, I'll tell you a secret now. That I came out here figuring that this would be a flop. One day would be about all I could take. And I was to call my secretary, and we had a signal that would appear in the conversation, and she would then call back and tell whoever answered the phone to please contact me that I was called to be in Washington immediately. He said, the reason you may have heard I've been up most every night, she goes down to the office, and we do my day's work over the telephone. At night. That's what I've been doing at night. He said, you just don't realize what this does to a man like me. He said, I'm president of American Bridge, board of directors U.S. Steel. I have a big corner office. But he said, who do I see? The people that the receptionist and secretary decide I shall see. Who do I talk to? The same thing. What mail do I get? The letters that she decides to bring in. He said, here I've gotten a breath of fresh air that I've just never had before. He said, I'm one of those lonely men. He said, when you get the top, you're lonely. He said, this has been wonderful. Well, that was the first year. And it's run pretty well. We gave more and more of it to students until they really run the whole thing now.
May I go off this for a moment,
yes,
will you? All right, now we're back on the tape talking about the old master's program.
I just wanted to comment on one or two things that have grown out of this. First of all, I think the students love them. I have yet, as I've heard you comment, to see a student host or hostess that hasn't gotten a tremendous reward out of this. There are just two incidents, as long as we're just reminiscing. Along about the third or fourth year, we had the student committee together and we were talking about who we might get, who they could get. Kid that was sitting across the room where I happened to be sitting, the student was chairing the meeting, got up and said, now I want to say something different. But we talk about successful people. I'd like to invite our mailman. Everybody in the room turned and looked at him. He said, now just a minute. To me, he is really what we call a successful man in the United States. He said, he is just finishing putting his seventh child through college as a mailman. Now, he said, this hasn't been easy. He said, I'm not even sure he finished the eighth grade. He can read, obviously. He said, he believes in education, and he's been willing to put his money where his mouth is. And I think he's been successful. Well, in that particular year, the mailman couldn't come or wouldn't come. I think he was too reticent to come. But the next year, we started in on the same thing. We found a lady who was foreman of the General Electric plant, in the General Electric plant of Fort Wayne, who was handling, I don't know, 400 or 500 women working under. And she agreed to come down. I think she was probably the most fascinating and interesting person we've ever had. Now, it's all hard to compare these people. But she had dropped out of school in the sixth grade, had fought her way up on her own, and when it came to talking about what makes life go and what makes things live, she had answers because she'd been through it. And it, we've had several. Not any that I recall quite as, the dropped out of school as early as she did. But we've had many non-college graduates, and they've paid dividends, that you don't have to go to college. In fact, sometimes maybe you shouldn't. Well, the old master's program is still going, and I think we've hammered
it. It is a success.
Oh, I don't think any question.
You know, you've been talking to me about the student committees. What about the, would you like to launch on to one of the most important topics that we've got to talk about, which is the development and changes in student government?
Yes, this is very interesting. Development. If I go back to when I came, due to the mixed up mess in the campus, we really didn't have any student government.
Well, as that, I remember, you had some people who were in fraternities who thought the fraternity might look good if it had the president.
This is right.
And you had others who didn't care.
Well, and we had an Office of Student Affairs or Student Services, I can't remember which spent most of their time getting rides back and forth from this point and that point for students. And we finally got a student government organized, got the students to do it. What actually happened, Bob, was then for about every 3 years we reorganized student government, because the students always wanted their organization in there, not the one that came from students 3 or 4 years ago. It was never any good. I don't know why, but it was never any good. Our current government comes basically from a group that operated in about 1954. And they had asked the staffs of the Dean of Men, Dean of Women, and Dean Hockham of the President's staff to work with them in organizing a student government. The format they worked out is pretty much the one we're still operating under. The rules and regulations and laws and so on are entirely different. But that was worked out really on the floor of the Dean of Men, Dean of Women's waiting room, when they took a big roll of wrapping paper and unrolled it on the floor and had a strip of paper the length of that waiting room and proceeded to put different possibilities on this thing in a red pencil. I can still see this. They had brought in food. It was Sunday evening. And when they came in, they'd brought in food. And we took time out to eat and drink, dripping it on the drawings on the paper as they argued. This is one of those cases where we had various groups, and they would go into some of the offices and caucus and come out, and this is the way it went. But this is was the format.
In a sense, then, the students did write the form of student government.
Oh, they didn't write it. Nothing's going to happen until they change it.
Now, if this is so, this fact has not been publicized too much, because most of the criticism of the administration and its relation to students in the past 5 years has been on the assumption that the government and form of student government is something that has been thrust down the throats of the students.
Yeah.
This fact ought to be recorded for as
well. Well, this is right. However, Bob, you can record it. And in 4 or 5 years, you'll be right back where you point out we are now. Because the office of the Dean of Men, Dean of Women, other university offices are the continuing part of this whole program that carries it on, and they get blamed for being the ones that originated it. Not that they're carrying it through, but that they thought of it. Because every new freshman comes in thinks this is a brand new idea. Nobody ever had this student government before. Now, I'm just exaggerating, but it's what has happened to a large degree. Our student government today is completely independent. More so in many instances than they would like to be. But we think they're doing a reasonable job. The student government on the Purdue campus, of course, is in a little different position than the student government on any other campus I know of. It's a mere fact that student government really, now they had it before, but as we now know it, came into being since I've been here, since you've been here. Then you go to, I think, any other Big Ten school, and you'll find that you can go clear back to the 30s and the 20s, and maybe the teens, where the student government became the central governing body. Now, Purdue, by the time student government came along, had your Pendragon in the residence halls and the organization of the women's residence halls, your IFC, your Panhell, your union board. We go on down the line in student groups that are really governing groups. And they have a vested interest that they're not going to let go of. And therefore, the student government per se has only what is left. And this has been a problem that student government has faced for years.
That is, you are faced with, a student government is faced with certain autonomous bodies over which it cannot...
Of their peers.
Of their peers, and of which it cannot exercise control.
This is right.
Well, now, is there any reason for allowing this situation to go on?
Well, now you see you're pushing me right back into the position where you claimed the students thought we were a little while ago. The only way to get rid of this
is through the students.
Well, at the present time, it would be through the administration, and we're not going to do it. Now, if you get rid of it through the students, fine. But they won't do it.
In other words, you're not going to dictate to the students what they, the kind of student government they're
going to have. I never have, and I don't intend to start now.
Very good. I wanted to get that on the record.
No, this has been one of the things we've held to pretty rigidly. It's just like the open door policy. I think that every door in the university has to be open to students within reason. And by and large, we follow that. Now, there are exceptions, but we shan't go into those. We'll sit down and talk to students any time of day or night. By we, I don't mean just myself and personnel officers. You would, too, if you were called upon. And so most of the faculty would. This is something that Purdue has hung on to and I think believes in. I suppose this accounts for many of the mores and so on that have developed around the university, and the spirit, which I think's been pretty good. Well, what else you got, Bob?
Well, then there's a problem of keeping the students dressed and fed. I would say one of the big problems was how can a poor boy get through Purdue in the sense of loans, emergency loans?
Well,
and financial aid.
I remember we had talked about emergency loans, and let's separate this from financial aid for the moment. They both are financial aid. Once again, this started just about the time George Davis was leaving. The people over at the residence halls came over one morning completely stymied. They had uncovered a ring that was selling the football parlay cards, you recall, that we had in the 50s. Came out on Tuesday and had to be in by Friday, and so on and so forth. With a little investigation, we traced it all back to one boy, who was one of the last of the veterans. He had gone in late and had been kept over for his period of enlistment, and he was running it. Well, this may sound strange, but I'm convinced the boy was as honest as he could be. All of the other male members of his family, there were four or five of them, ran gambling establishments of one kind or another back in New York. And he just didn't see anything wrong with it. He didn't realize that it was illegal. Well, we talked to this boy, going to say by the hour, and this is almost literally true. Then this went on for 4 or 5 days. The cards were pulled back immediately. He collected all of his cards. And this was only his second week of operation, so he hadn't bled the campus completely. We got to meeting as to what we could do. The residence hall people had insisted that he move out of the hall, and he was out of the hall. But this was also a university violation. Now, people in the university, unless you're in the middle of it, I think forget that discipline is a very difficult thing to enforce because you don't have very many types. I can sit down and slap your wrist verbally. I can suspend you, expel you, in other words, get you out of school. And beyond that, there isn't very much that you can do in discipline. I can't turn a student over my knee and paddle him. I grant there have been times in the past when I would like to. But this whole matter of discipline is a difficult thing, and it's almost it almost demands much imagination as some of the other things you do. Well, it struck me one night when I was home. We have students who need $10 to get through the week, or students who, for one reason or another, need some money for a short period of time. We have no loans to take care of these students. You have to go through the whole long-term form and get the interest cleared, and maybe it's only for 5 or 6 days.
In other words, to give the kid a little money when he really needs it.
Yeah. Well, we called the boy in and asked him how much money he'd made in the 1 week he'd been operating. Well, I think I probably had my leg pulled a little. When he said, I don't know, $35 or $40, but well and good. The money was worth a little more then, I guess. At any rate, we took this and explained to him that we wanted to set up an emergency loan fund. Well, this thing has grown. People begin to hear about it. We had a mother that heard about it and got quite enthusiastic about it. Gave us $1,200, not in a lump, but this was during the time boys in school. Her boy wasn't borrowing. He didn't need to borrow. But in her gifts, she always put in, may be loaned or given. Now, we use that given very, very seldom. I remember the first time we used it, we had a boy that had to get a new pair of glasses because his others had been stepped on. Bob, you want us?
Yes, we'll go off the tape. All right, now we're back on the tape discussing emergency loans.
I was talking about the boy with these glasses. And he couldn't study 30 seconds without them. And there was no chance of his getting the money to get them, and we gave him the money. It's the first gift out of the emergency loan fund we ever made. I'm not sure where I ended up with our friend selling the parlay cards. But at any rate, he agreed that he would give the money he had made from the cards to this type of fund. And that was the start
of
the emergency loan fund.
Now, have the emergency loans come from any other fund at the university, or have they been the result of gifts of interested people?
The loans themselves have been the result of gifts, students and organizations and so on. There have been times when we run out of money. And at these times, we have borrowed money from other university loan funds on a purely temporary basis. See, the emergency loans at the present time may not exceed $75 and 30 days. It's been a godsend. The loan fund itself and the Dean of Men's Office, and the Dean of Women's Office has one now too. The Dean of Men's Office turns over 6 to 8 times a year. Jimmy, the check didn't get here from home. He's got a date tonight. We'll give him $10 to have his date. Check will come in on Monday, and we'll get the money back. The losses have been way under 1% of the loans. It's just a mere fraction. And but it all grew out of a boy that just wasn't raised in the middle. Well, you might be interested in a little further about this boy that was selling the cards. He graduated and left here and graduated with a pretty good record. and went with one of the oil companies and went over to Saudi Arabia or in that area. When he got his first furlough, which I think is 2 years later, he came back. Came in and wanted to know how his loan fund was doing, and I told him, and he made another small donation. But he was just as proud as could be. And then as he got ready to leave, he said, you know, Dean, I've never told you this, but the day that you and I sat down in the office and you explained to me about the gambling, that was the first time I ever recognized the social problem that gambling brings. Now this, here in the Middle West, it's just hard for us to believe this. But I think he was absolutely honest.
I have no doubt of it.
And he said, this has changed my whole outlook. I've lost complete track of him now. I don't know where he is. He was going back, taking his 3 months vacation. And going back, and I don't know where he is now, and I can't remember his name on the spur of the moment. We were talking earlier about some of the early meetings we had in orientation. We're going to get together again, but may I close this with a little narrative. While George Davis was still meeting, and we had always at orientation, we always had a meeting of parents. This has grown into the parents' meeting, which we have now, which is pretty well structured. But we weren't admitting many students at a time, except the veterans. And George was talking to the parents, and he said, he always ended with this, if there's anything we can do to help you or your boy, let us know. Applause, the crowd leaves, we're done. On this particular year, we ended with the same note. But some 4 or 5 months later, comes a letter to George, recalling his words, and it was word for word, quoted right back at him. She said, I will send you the money when you let me know how much it is. But my son, Billy, is a freshman. He turns 19 on such and such a date. Since his first birthday, he has never failed to have a birthday cake. I want you to go down and get him a birthday cake, and it is to be lavender frosting and pink roses on top of it. Well, George did it. Then when it came time to deliver it, he said, come on, you're going with me. So we went over and found the boy. In order not to embarrass him, we called him down in one of the lounges, gave him the cake, and told him he could handle it any way he wanted to. But every year we got this letter from her. In his senior year, she had two boys in school, and we had two cakes to get. This is the only time it's ever happened, but it really got to be funny. Well,
I think that's wonderful. Now, this is the end of tape number one of the first interview with Vice President Mallett, and it closes the interview of July the 2nd, 1972. My error, 1970.